Welcome to The Bitter Witness.
Don't be scared.
Hello. Welcome back. I'm Rebecca. I'm your host for The Bitter Witness. I hope you've had a good week. I've had a very rainy week in my little corner of Ontario. I'm trying to have a yard sale, but every time I try and schedule it, it just downpours with rain. So hopefully we're done with this rain, because I've had about enough. I'm ready to get out in the gardens in some sun. I want to thank all the people who have joined up to subscribe on Spotify. It really meant a lot that we made that goal. And so hopefully we can just keep going up from here. The dogs are sleeping behind me, so puppy ASMR will be brought to you by both Miley and Piper today. I have a trigger warning for today's episode. It is particularly gruesome. In today's case, we're going to be talking about domestic violence, physical, emotional, mental abuse, cannibalism. I don't have any other way to say this, but indignity to bodies, I would use. It's not a fun case, and the perpetrator of this crime is still alive and in jail, thank God. So grab a cup of tea, sit back, relax, while I tell you about the case of Catherine Mary Knight, the first woman to be sentenced to life without parole in Australia. As always, I want to give the victims in this case top billing. In this case, there are several victims, but there's only one murder. To all the victims of Catherine Mary Knight, but particularly Pricey, I acknowledge you and I send my love to you wherever you may be. Catherine Mary Knight was born on October 24th, 1955, to Barbara and Jack Ruffin. The family was located in Aberdeen, New South Wales, Australia. Knight was the younger of a set of twins. Her mother, Barbara, had had an affair with a man named Ken Knight, and from what I could find there, it is possible that the twins were actually fathered by Ken Knight. But I never actually saw it written anywhere. But that was the assumption that you got while you were reading through her history. Barbara and Jack Ruffin split, and Jack, I think there's a bird in the back of my house. Okay, that screeching is getting out of control. I'm going to pause for a moment and go investigate. I'll be right back. I don't know if you heard any of that squealing, but it's not a bird. It's a freaking squirrel in the back porch of my house. He's running around freaking out, but I'm going to leave him there because I don't want to go anywhere near him. Nobody else is awake right now, so I guess we're going to have to wait until somebody gets up. One of the boys is going to have to deal with that because I am not going near that. Squirrels are crazy, man. They'll kill you. So let's continue on. Ignore the screams of terror coming from the small squirrel in the back of my house. Barbara and Jack Ruffin split. Jack was a violent, abusive alcoholic, and he died in 1959. By this time, Knight's mother, Barbara, was now living with Ken Knight. While growing up, other than her twin, Knight was really only close to her uncle, Oscar. Unfortunately, Oscar committed suicide in 1969, which absolutely devastated Knight. One description of Knight stated that she was a pleasant girl for the most part, but would fly into murderous rages as a child when someone did something that upset her. In fact, she actually received awards for good behavior at different points throughout her childhood, but then the rages would pop up. At one point, she assaulted a male student with a weapon, and in another incident during her school years, a teacher actually injured Knight during an altercation, but throughout the investigation into the incident, it was determined that Knight had flown into a rage directed at the teacher, and the teacher was only acting in self-defense. Those who attended school with Knight described her as a bully and a loner. Can you say major red flags? And of course, nothing was done to intervene with Knight. Let's say, I don't know, counseling, mentorship, anything like that. But this is back in the 60s, so we all know how people felt about therapy and acknowledging trauma back in the 60s. It just didn't happen. So Knight left school at 15 without the ability to read or write. She was able to find employment as a fabric cutter for a little while, but eventually she was able to find what she described as her dream job. It was at an abattoir cutting up the offal. I'm not sure there are very many of us out there that would consider this a dream job, but to each their own, I guess. For those who don't know what offal is, it's the entrails and internal organs from slaughtered animals that are used in the production of food. Some of these foods that these parts are used in is foie gras, pâté, sweetbreads, which are three things I will never be putting near my mouth. Like, ever. Knight excelled at the abattoir and eventually was promoted to boning. Boning is where the butchers remove the bones from the larger pieces of meat while being processed. You have to have a steady hand and you have to be able to concentrate. As she had become a boner, she was given her own set of butcher knives. As someone who has lived with a butcher for over 20 years, I can tell you that butchers have this weird connection to their knives. The knives become an extension of the butcher. It's kind of creepy in some aspects, but in some professions, people become attached to things they work with on a daily basis, I guess. But with Knight, she had an over-the-top connection with her knives. She hung them over her bed. And when asked about this, I'm going to say, really creepy habit, she stated that she had them there so they would be handy if she needed them. Okay. I'm sure there are a million reasons why you would need a boning knife while lying in bed. Knight met David Kellett at the abattoir, a co-worker, in 1973, and she immediately dominated him. David himself was a hard-working and hard-drinking man. I've known a few butchers in my life, and most of them were like this. They worked hard, they partied harder. Co-workers stated that Knight would step behind David in a bar fight and back him up. And back him up well. This woman was a ruffian. And when you look at the pictures of her, she's like an 80s mom with the glasses and blonde hair. You would never guess that this smiling, pretty woman would be able to kick your ass in a bar if you looked at her wrong. In 1974, Knight told David that they were getting married, and they did. The couple showed up to the wedding on Knight's motorcycle. Knight was driving, and a very drunk David was on the back of the bike. David later stated that when the couple got to the wedding, Knight's mother pulled him aside and told him this, quote, "Watch out. You better watch this one or she'll fucking kill you. Stir her up the wrong way or do the wrong thing and you're fucked. Don't ever think of playing up on her. She'll fucking kill you." And that was her mother talking. She told me she's got something loose. She's got a screw loose somewhere. Unquote. Now, I'm not one to judge. Okay, I am. But if I got to my wedding and the person who I'm marrying's parent pulled me aside and told me this, I think I would be leaving. I don't think I would be going down that aisle. In my notes, I wrote, "Well, that's encouraging coming from your future mother-in-law about the woman you're about to pledge your heart to for the rest of your life." The next thing that she did is just unreal. On their wedding night, Catherine Knight strangled David Kellett because he fell asleep after they had only had sex 3 times. Understandable, I think. Don't you agree? Jesus. If I was David, I would have run for the fucking hills. This woman is a nightmare. This is a tough story to read because, and I'm trying to throw some humor in here because it's about to get horrid. According to all the reports I read, the marriage between Knight and David was filled with violence. I know, shocker. One incident that occurred between the couple happened when Knight was very, very pregnant. David had attended a darts tournament one night. His team ended up making it to the playoffs, but that meant that David was going to be late coming home. Needless to say, Knight was not a happy woman, and she proceeded to burn all of his clothes and shoes, then slammed him in the back of the head with a frying pan, which I'm assuming was a good old heavy cast iron pan. David, who was terrified for his life, ran to a neighbor's house and collapsed. The neighbors took him to the hospital, where he was treated for a fractured skull. Police wanted to charge Knight with domestic abuse and assault, but David was manipulated by a very regretful Knight, and he refused to press charges against his wife. In May 1976, shortly after their first child, Melissa, was born, David left Knight for another woman and moved away to Queensland, Australia. He stated that he couldn't live with her possessiveness, jealousy, and violence anymore. The next day, Knight was seen out for a walk on the main street with the new baby Melissa inside a stroller. But it wasn't a normal new mom out walking her new baby. Witnesses stated that Knight was violently throwing the stroller from side to side. Luckily, the townspeople intervened. Knight was taken to a hospital and was admitted with postnatal depression. She was kept in the hospital for a few weeks. After she was released from the hospital, she took baby Melissa and placed her on a set of railway tracks. Oh, you heard me. She left the baby there and then took an axe and started going through the town, threatening to kill people. Knight was arrested and taken back to the hospital again. Thankfully, a local man known as Old Ted was foraging for food near the tracks and saved little Melissa just before a train came through. And this part just blows my mind. Knight decided that she was fine and didn't need to be in the hospital anymore, and somehow was able to sign herself out of the hospital the next day. A few days after this railway tracks incident, Knight slashed the face of a woman she knew and forced the woman to drive her to Queensland to find David. Luckily, the woman was able to escape from Knight when Knight told the woman to stop for gas on the way. She was able to get to the attendant of the station and call the police, and then the two of them hid from Knight while they were waiting for the police to arrive. But by the time the police arrived, Knight had grabbed a little boy passing by the station and was holding him hostage with her knife. The police attacked Knight with brooms and were able to disarm her and arrest her without the young boy being hurt, physically. Traumatized, but not physically injured by this whacked out bitch. This time, Knight was admitted to another psychiatric hospital. While there, she told her doctors that she had planned to kill the mechanic at that specific station. That's why she told the woman to stop there for gas. It was because the mechanic had fixed David's car, which allowed him to move away to Queensland and leave her. Then she stated that she had planned to kill both David and David's mother once she got to Queensland. This woman is a holy nightmare. Can you imagine this woman being your mother? This is insane. We're not even at the murder yet. We're not even close to the murder. While I was reading all the things about Catherine Knight on the internet doing the research, I kept thinking to myself, these stories must be exaggerated. This can't be real. And then I found the court papers from the trial on the murder, and a lot of these are taken from there. So this is all true. Unbelievable. So after Knight was put in the hospital after trying to get to Queensland, the police went to David in Queensland and told him what Knight did and what her plan was. They wanted to warn David that she had it out for him and he needed to be careful. So what do you think that David did? Just give it a guess. I'll give you a second. If it was me, I would have fucking moved away. Far away. Like the other side of the world far away. But not David. David immediately broke up with the woman he was living with, and then both he and his mother moved back to Aberdeen to look after Knight when she was released from the hospital. I'm sorry, what? What? Dude, you were away from her. Why would you go back? She was on her way to kill you and you go back? This part just blew my mind. I understand about domestic violence and the attachment that can come between a victim and the assaulter in a domestic relationship. But this goes to another level of connection. He had been living and having a relationship with this other woman for a while, and he just dropped her as soon as he found out that Knight was in the hospital and she had been on her way to kill him. I don't understand that one at all. I don't understand that move. I don't think I ever will, and I don't think anyone else will. But this story really blows my mind. On August 9th, 1976, Knight was released from the psychiatric hospital into the care of David and David's mother. They all moved to a suburb of Brisbane. In March of 1980, they had another daughter, Natasha. The family seemed to be existing as well as can be expected for a couple of years. But in 1984, Knight decided to leave David and move back to her parents' house in Aberdeen. Once back with her parents, she went back to work at the abattoir, but shortly after returning to the abattoir, she injured her back and had to stop work and go on disability. This is going to be a great thing for Catherine, because now she has nowhere to go and nothing to do except sit and perseverate on whichever man she's with. Knight met a man named David Saunders in 1986. He was a hard-working miner, and the couple soon moved in together, along with Knight's two daughters, Melissa and Natasha. I'm going to call him Saunders because he's the second David in this case. Although Saunders had moved in with Knight, he was able to keep his apartment, and lucky for him that he did. As time went by, Knight returned to her jealous, violent ways. She would be ridiculously suspicious of Saunders whenever he was away from her for any reason. Running to the store or going to work, Knight would often kick him out and then go and beg him to come back to her. Classic domestic abuser behavior. In May of 1987, Knight, trigger warning, there's animal abuse here. I forgot to put this in the original trigger warning at the start of the episode, but trigger warning, this is going to be bad. In May of 1987, the couple got into a big fight, and for some reason, Knight wanted to show Saunders what would happen to him if he ever had an affair on her. So she grabbed Saunders' new puppy and slit its throat. After she horribly murdered this puppy, she knocked Saunders unconscious with a frying pan. That would be the end of it. If you kill a dog, you're done in my books. You're a piece of shit. Actually, no. You're below a piece of shit. You're the mold that grows on pieces of dog shit out on the street. That's what you are. And you smell bad. In 1988, Knight gave birth to a third daughter, Sarah. Becoming a father made Saunders think about the future, and he put a deposit down on a house. In 1989, Knight received a payout from workers' compensation for the back injury that she had suffered at the abattoir, and with the payout, she paid off the house. She decorated the entire house with animal skins, animal skulls, horns, leather jackets, old boots, machetes, rakes, rusty animal traps, and pitchforks. I'm going to let that sink in. These were all over the walls. People stated that there was absolutely no wall space left, and everything was covered with something creepy. Does this remind you of, I don't know, Ed Gein? Ed Gein's house? It was covered in this kind of creepy crap. But his was human. This is all animal stuff, thank God. During an argument between Saunders and Knight, she smashed him in the face with an iron, then stabbed him in the stomach with a pair of scissors. Saunders had had enough, and he left and went into hiding. Knight tried to find him, but no one would tell her where Saunders was. Eventually, he went back to the house to see his daughter, Sarah, only to find out that Knight had cut up all his clothes and had gone to the police and told them that she was terrified of Saunders because he was violent towards her. And somehow she was able to get an apprehended violence order. That's what they call a restraining order, basically, in Australia. So somehow she was able to convince the police that he was violent to her and she was terrified of him. Once Knight was able to manipulate the police and the judges into giving her a restraining order against Saunders, that was pretty much the end of their relationship. After Saunders left, she began a relationship with a man named John Chillingworth. He was a co-worker of hers when she worked at the abattoir. And in 1990, she gave birth to a boy, Eric. After 3 years, the relationship ended when Knight left John to be with a man she had been having an affair with for a while. This new man that she had been having the affair with was John Price. Friends called him Pricey. So we're going to call him Pricey as well, because now he's the second John, just so that everybody can keep this straight. So now we've had the first David, the second David, the first John, now the second John. We're on Pricey. Pricey had 3 children with his ex-wife. His marriage had ended in 1988, and his 2 older children lived with him while his youngest child lived with his ex-wife. According to many who knew Pricey, he was a good bloke. He was liked by everyone who knew him. In 1995, Knight moved in with Pricey. Even though Pricey knew about Knight's violent background with men, Pricey was making good money working in the mines, and his children, they seemed to like Knight. And other than the odd violent argument between Knight and Pricey, according to Pricey, life was a bunch of roses. Can we just stop for a second? Did you hear what I just said? Apart from the odd violent argument? No, I'm sorry, no. If you're having even one violent argument, there is something broken and it needs to be fixed immediately, like by someone leaving the house. This is not okay. But I feel that this is a mindset that is often prevalent in cases of domestic violence, where the man is the victim in a heterosexual relationship. I feel that they feel that once in a while, if she goes off the rails, it's fine, I can handle it. And I think that's not okay, guys. If a woman is hitting you in anger and rage, you need to get out of there. You can be just as much a victim as anybody else. In 1998, Knight decided it was time for Pricey to marry her. However, Pricey didn't think it was something that he wanted to do. Naturally, a violent argument erupted when Knight was turned down from her marriage proposal. Knight was pissed about the rejection. So in retaliation, she videotaped items that Pricey had stolen from his work. And then she sent the videos to Pricey's boss. The things that Pricey had taken were out-of-date medical kits that the company had thrown away. He literally took the company's trash. But regardless, the company considered it theft, and Pricey was fired from his job, and he had had this job for over 17 years. On the same day that Pricey was fired, he kicked Knight out of his house. Naturally, in the small town, news of what Knight had done started spreading like wildfire. And let's just say she didn't have a lot of friends left. A few months after this incident, Pricey restarted his relationship with Knight, but this time he refused to allow her to move in with him. But the fights were increasing in frequency and in violence. In fact, the fighting had become so bad that many of Pricey's friends refused to hang out with him if he was still with Knight. It was just too much. Listen, if you're in a relationship and it's reached the point where your friends don't want anything to do with you, you need to stop and take a look around yourself. It's time to walk away. Sadly, though, Pricey didn't walk away. The relationship kept going and the violence just kept increasing. On the night of February 28th, Pricey woke in the middle of the night, and Knight was standing at the end of his bed, watching him sleep with her hands behind her back. During the argument that followed, Knight stabbed Pricey in the chest. Pricey kicked Knight out of the house that night, and the next day, February 29th, it was a leap year, Pricey stopped by the courthouse on the way to work and got a restraining order against Knight. While Pricey was at work on the 29th, he told his coworkers that if he didn't show up for work the next day, it was because Knight had murdered him. His friends and coworkers begged Pricey not to go home, but Pricey told them he was terrified that if he didn't, Knight would kill his children. When Pricey got home from work that night, he found that Knight wasn't at his house, but she had sent the kids to their friends' houses for sleepovers. That would terrify me. Because remember, Knight and Pricey have a child together, so she's going to be there to look after the kids. Pricey went over to his neighbor's house to hang out and have a few drinks for a while that night, and at around 11 p.m. he went home to go to bed. While Pricey was at work that day, Knight had gone out shopping for new lingerie. She came back to the house and started videotaping all of the kids, and she was making weird comments on the videotape that the kids really didn't understand, like, I hope I get to see my kids again someday, and things like that. In court, the prosecutors determined that this was actually like a crude thrown together will that Knight was making. So that night, Knight came back to the house while Pricey was asleep. She came into the house and she sat on the couch for a bit watching TV. Then she went and took a shower. Then she put on the new lingerie and went in to wake Pricey up. The couple had sex, and then Pricey fell back asleep. The next morning, one of Pricey's neighbors became concerned when they noticed that Pricey's car was still in the driveway at 6 a.m. Pricey should have been at work by that time. When Pricey didn't show up for work, his boss became concerned about him and sent one of his co-workers to the house to see what was going on and make sure Pricey was okay. When the co-worker arrived at Pricey's house, both the co-worker and the neighbor tried knocking on the front door to get Pricey to come to the door, but no one answered. However, both of them saw the smear of blood on the front door. Growing immediately concerned, they started knocking on Pricey's bedroom window, but there was still no answer. They called the police, and at 8 a.m., the police arrived. They broke down the back door of Pricey's house and walked into a nightmare. They found Knight lying in bed in the master bedroom, unconscious. When they were able to arouse Knight somewhat, she told them that she had taken a large amount of pills in a supposed suicide attempt. The police continued looking through the house, and in the living room, they found the remains of Pricey's skinned body, minus many pieces, and no head. Basically, it was just a bloody blob with legs. Knight had positioned what was left of Pricey on the couch with his one arm draped over a large bottle of pop. She had crossed his legs in the sitting position. But this was just the beginning of the nightmare for these officers. According to the blood evidence at the scene, Knight had stabbed Pricey with a butcher knife, probably while he was sleeping. Pricey awoke and tried to turn on the light beside the bed. He then realized what was going on and he tried to escape the house, but Knight was chasing him through the house with the knife. He was able to open the front door and exit the house, but he either stumbled back inside or was dragged back into the house by Knight. My money would be on her dragging him back inside because I'm sure he had lost a lot of blood at this point from the stab wound. Either way, Pricey was back inside the house in the front hall, either by his own volition or by Knight's. But police believe from the blood evidence that he died in the front hallway of severe blood loss. And they could tell this because there was a large pool of blood that was on the floor of the front hallway. So he was in situ while he was bleeding out. The autopsy done on Pricey stated that he had been stabbed at least 37 times, both in the front and the back of his body. The court papers state that there were so many stab wounds to his neck that the coroner was unable to determine in actuality how many times Pricey had been stabbed. So he was stabbed probably way more than 37 times. And many of the wounds were deep and extended inside vital organs. The stab wounds included the aorta, both the lungs, the liver, the stomach, the descending colon, the pancreas, and the left kidney. The lower pole of the kidney had virtually been sliced off. That's how deep these cuts were. So she started stabbing him and did not stop. It must have been like a frenzy of slices and stabs and blood in that front hallway. But that is not where this story ends, my friends. No, no. It gets way, way worse. The court papers state that Knight proceeded to skin Pricey's body. And she was able to skin his body in such a way that all of his skin remained in one piece. In essence, she cut the pelt from his body. She did it so expertly that the coroner was able to sew the skin back on Pricey's body after the autopsy was completed, redressing him with his own skin. And she took every piece of skin off of his body, like every piece, even from his genitals. There was only one small piece of skin left on the body, and that was on the left upper chest. The skin that she left on the left upper chest, is where she had stabbed him the night before. Once she was done skinning Pricey, she hung the pelt of skin on a meat hook that she had hanging in the doorway to the living room. Then Knight proceeded to decapitate him, and she also cut large steak-like pieces from his butt cheeks. She then set the table for a family dinner with place cards on the table. Each place card had the names of Pricey's children on them. As well, there were notes beside each setting. Knight then proceeded to cook the pieces of Pricey along with baked potato, pumpkin, zucchini, cabbage, yellow squash, and gravy. She actually served all these veggies and the pieces of Pricey onto the two of the plates at the table. There was a third meal served onto a plate, but it was found thrown out the back door on the back lawn. Police speculated that Knight tried to eat that meal and couldn't stomach it and chucked it out the back door. The police found Pricey's head on the stove inside a pot with vegetables. Although the stove wasn't on, the temperature of the contents of the pot was around 40 to 50 Celsius, meaning two things: that she had cooked his head and that it had to have been cooking not that long before the police entered the house at 8 a.m. So my guess is that she was still cooking him when the neighbor and the co-worker were banging on the door to try and find Pricey, and she turned off the stove and jumped into bed. At some point during the night, Knight left the house and went downtown and withdrew $1,000 from Pricey's bank account. She then went back to the house and put the bank card back in his wallet. And that's important. I'll talk about that later. So that is the murder of Pricey. The horrifically, grisly, gruesome, horrifying murder. So let's look at a little bit of the court case and what happened and how she was convicted. So Knight claimed that from the get-go, she had no recollection of anything about the murder. She had no recollection about anything from that entire day. But then she said that the only thing she did remember was watching TV that night with Pricey. She told the police that she had taken two of her nerve pills and a bunch of Pricey's blood pressure medication. And she said because of that mixture of pills, she was trying to kill herself and she failed at the suicide and she had no memory. The pills wiped out her memory. But then, a few hours later, she told the police in great detail about the sex that she and Pricey had had that night. So I don't think the memory is completely gone, is what she's saying. There was a blood sample taken at the hospital from Knight when she got there because she was claiming that she had tried to kill herself. However, the blood test results show that she had taken her prescribed dose of nerve pills, which is only two pills and wouldn't have made her incapacitated or wipe her memory out, and an antihistamine, an allergy pill. She wasn't in a coma. She wasn't overdosing when the police arrived. She was completely faking it. During the trial, Knight's nephew stated that Knight had offered to pay him $500 to steal Pricey's car and wreck it so it could cause problems for Pricey. And then, at a later date, Knight asked the same nephew to throw acid in Pricey's face on the street. There is so much in the court papers, and most of it just goes over what I've already told you about Catherine Knight. But nevertheless, she was found guilty, But one thing throughout all the court papers, she had told many, many people that if Pricey had ever wronged her in any way, she would kill him and then get away with it by pretending to be mad or crazy. And she had told several people this, and they all came and testified. So Catherine Knight was found guilty and sentenced to life imprisonment, and there was no option for parole, meaning that she had to serve her sentence for the term of her natural life. This is a quote from the sentencing judge, and I'm going to read it to you. It's a little bit long, but I like it. Quote, "As I have said, the prisoner showed no mercy whatsoever to Mr. Price. The last minutes of his life must have been a time of abject terror for him, as they were a time of utter enjoyment for her. At no time during the hearing or prior thereto did the prisoner express any regret for what she had done or any remorse for having done it. Not even through the surrogacy of counsel. Her attitude in that regard is consistent with her general approach to the many acts of violence which she had engaged in against her various partners, namely, they deserved it. In addition, the prisoner's history of violence, together with her flawed personality, caused me to conclude, along with Dr. Milton and the other psychiatrists called in this case, that she is, without a doubt, a very dangerous person and likely, if released into the community, to commit further acts of serious violence, including even murder, against those who cross her, particularly males. A crime of the kind committed by the prisoner calls for the maximum penalty the law empowers the court to impose. An examination of the cases referred to by counsel supports the view that I have formed, namely, that the only appropriate penalty for the prisoner is life imprisonment and that parole should never be considered for her. The prisoner should never be released." Unquote. Knight appealed her sentence, claiming it was too harsh and that the judge didn't take any of her mitigating circumstances into consideration. During the trial, they called in, I think, 3 psychiatrists to examine Knight, and they all agreed that she had a personality disorder, but they all stated that that personality disorder had nothing to do with the murder. They all stated that the personality disorder did not influence Knight to commit the murder. She committed the murder because she wanted to. So her appeal was rejected, and to this day, Catherine Knight lives inside a prison cell, and she will stay there until her last breath on this earth. My thoughts. This woman is brutal. So far, I don't think we've covered anyone as evil and sadistic as this bitch. When you Google her picture, she literally looks like an 80s mom. She has a great big smile, and she doesn't have the appearance of this tough, fighting, hard-drinking ruffian. Seriously, she looks like she's ready to go shopping at the mall or get her glamour shots done. Many of the psychiatrists that diagnosed her for the trial, like I said, stated that she had a personality disorder. It had nothing to do with what she did to Pricey. Her personality disorder did not inhibit her from comprehending what was right and what was wrong. She knew what she was doing. She knew that it was wrong, and she did it anyway because she didn't care. And so because of that, she has the classic signs of a psychopathic domestic abuser. She showed no remorse for what she did. When she was playing the amnesia card at the hospital, she didn't show any emotion when they told her what she had done and that Pricey was dead. And that just shows the lack of, or the level of lack of, emotion in this human. It's actually chilling. Thank God she didn't get her hands on Pricey's children. She was a mother to children, and that terrifies me. I would be very interested to know what she was like with the kids when they were little, because this woman embraced violence her whole life. And I hope that her kids are okay. I hope that they were able to get therapy and move on with their lives. And I mean, I don't know how you would ever move on from having a mother this evil and this horrible. But I really hope that their lives turned out okay. I'm going to look at a couple points and then that'll be it, because this is a horrible crime. So she said she was suffering from amnesia or suffering from a blackout. But if she was, which she wasn't, we all know she wasn't, how would she know that she took the pills? According to her, she took them at night, which fell into the time period she claimed she had amnesia. She said she had amnesia for the full day prior to the murder. So how does she remember taking the pills? Mm-hmm. And if she had taken the amount of drugs that she claimed she took, there's no way she would have been able to do all the things she did that night. The murder, the skinning, the cooking, the setting of the table. Don't forget, she drove to an ATM, used Pricey's card, which she took out of his wallet, withdrew $1,000, then drove back to Pricey's house and put the bank card back inside his wallet. She knew exactly what she was doing, and she knew it was wrong. Catherine Knight is a cold-hearted, callous killer whose main motive in life is paying back anyone who wrongs her, no matter who it is, even the person she's in a relationship with. Being callous at the level that Knight is does not mean there is an absence of knowledge as to what is right or wrong. It simply means that she doesn't care about doing what she is doing. Catherine Knight feels entitled to express herself in any means she sees fit for the situation at hand. No matter who gets hurt or killed in the process is irrelevant to her, as long as her own personal feelings of revenge are gratified. That was gruesome. She is insane. I mean, I don't like calling people insane, but this bitch was crazy. She would be able to walk up to you and look like an 80s mom and that she's going to sit down and chat with you and then totally pull out a knife and slice your throat. She scares me. I hope they never let her out. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for coming back. If you feel like it, subscribe to the podcast. You can subscribe on Spotify, or if you don't want to do that, you can head over to our Patreon page and join the Patreon group. Both have access to the Bitter Bits, little bonus episodes that I make. I've put two up here on Spotify so far. I want to thank everyone for the support. So with that said, I hope you have a wonderful week. Enjoy your day today. This has been a Bitter Witness production.